Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not-so-old. Coming up in this edition, we'll be taking a look back at a couple of the more cheerful things that happened during 2020, namely the fact that the Vaux Electric Railway Association, or VERA for short, was the winner of the prestigious Heritage Railway Award for that year, and that, despite all the restrictions, an annual count of butterfly arranged by the organisation Butterfly Conservation was able to take place as normal. Coming more up to date with the current year, we'll be hearing about a new free service provided by an online pharmacy, which is designed to help people who have to take several medications every day remember which ones to take and at what time to take them. On a more serious note, we'll be hearing how the COVID restrictions have affected funerals and what can still be done to make sure that a funeral is a fitting farewell to the deceased. And we'll be hearing about how research shows that some common foods contain ingredients which are able to help against cancer. As usual, we'll be giving out various phone numbers, email addresses and website addresses during the course of the programme, so you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. OK, well, let's get started by hearing about the pill delivery service. It's an unfortunate fact of life that as we get older, we end up probably having to take more and more medicines on a regular daily basis. And of course, this occurs just at a time of life when all of us, whether we're suffering from dementia or not, tend to become rather more forgetful. It can be quite a problem because if you're on several medicines, you may have to take one of them several times a day, another one once a day, and I know of at least one medicine which you only take one dose a week. So it can be quite difficult remembering which is which, and indeed remembering which you've taken. To find out more, I spoke to Dr. Hilary Jones, and I began by asking him how many medicines a typical patient in later life ends up taking.
We know that about 6.5 million people in the UK are taking more than five medicines every day. And this poses quite a challenge in terms of managing those medicines, making sure that the right people get the right medicines at the right time in the right dosage. And this is a task because 50% of people we know don't actually take the medicines as they are prescribed. And that has implications in terms of their health, keeping them well. And it has implications because it's so easy with some chronic conditions such as dementia chronic heart failure to forget if you've taken something. If you forget, then you're underdosed. If you think you've forgotten, you take another one, you're overdosed. So getting it right is a balancing act, but it's an important one.
Yes, this is something that I find. I've been on a regular daily medication for a long time, and I can't always remember whether I've taken it. I got so much into the habit of doing it. It's like all these things. You think afterwards, now, did I do that or not?
That's right.
I gather the effect of people not taking their medicine, apart from the fact that it can have an adverse effect on their health, it's also quite a cost to the NHS.
Absolutely. When people don't take their medicines as prescribed, it will affect their health. If it was an anticoagulant, for example, it could mean that their blood is more likely to clot or less likely to be anticoagulated. If it's a diabetic medication, their blood sugar isn't controlled, and that has long-term implications and short-term ones as well. So the cost of the NHS is around £2.5 billion as a result of people not taking their medicines as prescribed, and the wasted medicines cost another 300 million. So this is actually an important part of caring. And research conducted by Pilltime showed that many carers at the moment are actually dedicating an extra 6 hours every week to their job. And this is time that they can't then spend on themselves, looking after themselves. So an elderly carer can suffer as a consequence of what's happened during the pandemic, and it can affect their mental well-being as well as their physical health. But there are now mechanisms whereby life can be made easier. It's bad enough with just one medicine. Did I take the one medicine? But if you've got five, you can see how people can be easily confused. And, you know, there are systems whereby you can get an electronic prescription sent by your GP to an online pharmacy who can send you in the post to your home your medicines in sealed pouches with the right tablets in the right dose for the right time of day. So it's almost foolproof, because once you've opened the pouch, which is pre-sealed, you know you've had your medicine.
You mentioned Pill Time there. Can you tell me who they are?
They're an online pharmacy who are organising the ability of patients to have their electronic prescriptions fulfilled and sent to them in the post in these pre-sealed pouches. And of course, it makes life very much more easy for carers, because they don't have to count the medicines out or put them in little boxes and organisers and dispensers. They're in the pouches, all labelled and sealed, sent to their door, so no having to go to the pharmacy and park the car and wait in a queue outside because of the social distancing necessary. So it's something that's an innovation which I think has been very welcome.
Is this a service that's provided by lots of pharmacies?
There are online pharmacies doing similar things. Pill Time carried out this particular research. And their website is something I would recommend people to look at, pilltime.co.uk. But of course, the local pharmacy is doing a great job with deliveries. And I think we owe pharmacists and pharmacies a great debt of gratitude during the pandemic already for the services they've kept open throughout the pandemic. They've done a great job in providing deliveries, and they will be doing another great job when we get the vaccinations, because they'll be taking their part, taking a role in that as well.
Yes, they already deal with such things as flu vaccines, don't they?
That's correct, yeah.
So how much does this service cost, the Pill Time service?
Well, it doesn't cost the patient anything. It's a service, so they work just as any other pharmacy. So if your general practice to have your electronic prescription sent to Pill Time, that can be arranged.
Okay, and Pill Time itself is an actual pharmacy. So if you use them, the prescription won't go via your local pharmacy.
That's correct.
So they'll be losing trade in a way.
Well, I suppose if you think about the market being a competitive one, it is. There are excellent local pharmacies, independent pharmacies that do a great job. But there are also many inner city areas where it's difficult to get to a pharmacy. There isn't that sort of service, and where an online service which delivers to your door and gives you the convenience of these pre-sealed pouches can be very convenient. And so I think there's room for everybody.
And no doubt it's worth asking your local pharmacy if they can provide this service themselves.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, thank you very much, Dr. James. Can you remind me once again of Pill Time's website address?
It's pilltime.co.uk.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was talking to Dr. Hilary Jones about the Pill Time service. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to their website, which is pilltime.co.uk. That's pilltime.co.uk. Or you can phone them on 0800 074 3303. That's 0800 074 3303. Okay, well, now let's hear about one of the good things that happened during 2020. The Vaux Railway, down on Brighton Beach, has been going from strength to strength over the last few years. Back in 2016, they received a substantial grant from the Heritage Lottery Fund, which enabled them to do some much-needed maintenance and upgrading work. And in 2020, they received the prestigious Heritage Railway Award, in competition with all sorts of other preserved railway lines. All this is due to the hard work of a group of volunteers who go by the name of VERA, which stands for the Vaux Electric Railway Association. To find out more about it, Chris English went to talk to their chairman, Peter Williams, and he began by asking Peter what the distinction is between the Vaux Railway and VERA.
Well, the association is basically a group of members of the society with a hard core of volunteers that work week by week assist in the actual railway itself. The railway is owned by Brighton and Hove City Council, but we as the volunteers support them both with physical work and financially.
And without your help, the railway wouldn't survive, would it?
I think that's a fair assumption, actually, because over the years, this is our 25th year of existence now. And over that time, we've done an enormous amount of work and we've brought the railway up to a very, very high standard. We've just finished some major track work projects, and that puts the ride as best as you can possibly get with our ancient historic vehicles.
I mean, we're sitting here in a car, looking at the plaque. Car 7 was built in 1901. So,
yes, that's right, but that's not our oldest car. Our oldest car is number 4, which was built in 1892 and has many of its original features still in existence. So we're very, very pleased to have that car still running.
Now, you can probably hear rattling in the background the doors on the shed, because we're in the brand new shed, which was funded partly by the lottery.
It was. We received a 1.65 million heritage lottery grant in 2015, and so that work was completed in 2018 and has enabled the railway really to continue, we hope, for another 130 plus years.
Now, what is it about Volk's railway? I mean, Magnus Volk obviously was the originator of electric railways.
He was, and I think what the magic of the railway is the fact that it's his legacy. He was a pioneer in electrical engineer and a consummate inventor of all things electrical. And so we are very privileged to be able to keep the railway running as part of his legacy. You know, he died in 1937, and here we are, you know, in 2020, still able to say the railway is good for another 130 plus years. So it's a great achievement.
And some of those original cars were restored as part of that lottery.
Yes, as part of the lottery we selected three of the cars, numbers 4, 6 and 10, and they went off down to Alan Keefe Limited in Ross-on-Wye, and basically they were stripped down and all the reusable parts were put to one side. And so we've been able to give those cars a new life, basically. And if you can see inside this shed now, we've got the cars sitting here waiting for the next season to begin.
And is it a constant battle to keep them in running order?
Oh, yes. It's a great battle because we are on the Brighton seafront. We're on the beach. We've got the westerly winds blowing all the time, salt-laden atmosphere. You know, it is a major task to keep these cars and the railway itself operating smoothly.
And all of that comes to an award. You've just won an award.
Yes, we're very, very pleased to have done that. We applied for the Heritage Railway Award and we were notified that we were shortlisted. So we went up to Birmingham to the awards evening, and we all felt at the time that to be shortlisted was an accolade in itself, but to actually pick up an award was a great privilege and very humbling, because the competition that we were up against was absolutely brilliant.
I mean, you talk about competition. I mean, Talithlin Railway, some of the major heritage railways.
Yes, we were up against Festiniog, the Talithlin, the Isle of Wight Steam Railway, the Llangollen Railway, and all of them had major projects, track restoration. Some of them put up new telegraph poles of the old days. So we were extremely pleased to have received award like this against such wonderful other projects. It's a great tribute to all the hard work that the volunteers put in day after day, week after week. So, you know, as I say, that's extremely humbling for all of us here to have received that award. We do it because it's unique. This railway is the oldest operating electric railway in the world, and that's something that we have to safeguard for the future.
And do you think you can carry on that task? I mean, it's... Some might say it's an impossible task.
It's possibly an impossible task in 10 years' time when we're all now not able to lift heavy rail into position. But I think hopefully we'll have a future generation of volunteers who will be able to continue the work that we're doing now.
Peter, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Chris English was talking to Peter Williams about the Volks Electric Railway Association. If you'd like to find out more about the association, they don't seem to have a website as such, but they do have a Facebook page, which is at Volks Electric Railway Association. That's at Volks Electric Railway Association. Well, now I'm afraid we move on to a much less cheerful subject. It's an unfortunate fact that many of the less pleasant aspects of life before the coronavirus pandemic have had to continue. And one of them, of course, is funerals. During most of the time that the pandemic has been happening, the government has restricted the attendance at funerals to only 30 people, which is not a very high number, of course, when you consider the number of people who might want to attend. To find out whether funeral directors are happy with this, Chris English spoke to David Collingwood, who's the Director of Funerals for Co-op Funeral Care. And he began by asking David whether he considered that this small number was a good thing.
I think it is when you consider where we were at the start of the pandemic, where actually funerals in many places had a maximum attendance of only 10 people. And in some areas of the country, Chris, some local authorities actually banned anyone from attending. So, you know, the awful situation of, you know, not being at the funeral of your spouse or your loved one was very real for a number of families. So I think the government have recognised the importance that we all have in having a number of friends and family present. 30 isn't a lot, you know, and it's only where the premises can accommodate safely 30 people. In some areas, it might have to be reduced to 25 or less. But it's a really important point is actually it's allowing people to say their last goodbye to a loved one.
I mean, it is a very difficult subject to talk about, particularly at the moment with so many people suffering from COVID and unfortunately leaving us. Is it something that we should get used to, or do you think it's something that's inbuilt sympathy, that is?
I think death is a part of life, and grief and bereavement is the price we pay for love, for loving someone. I think what we're trying to do, the profession, and thankfully, you know, with the support of the government, is trying to make funerals as normal as we possibly can be and as personal, as unique as we possibly can be, to allow people to say their last goodbye in the right kind of way. It's an awful subject to have to talk about it. And thank you for including this on your show. I think it's really important. None of us can avoid death, but obviously it's a matter of ensuring that we do talk to our families about what our last wishes should be. And we do ensure that at least those that are left have got some idea as to what we would want, you know, for our funerals.
And how much can people get their wishes these days if we're limited to 30?
Well, do you know what? What's really different now is that actually for those that want, religious people can actually have a funeral service in a church, whereas previously they weren't allowed to do that. Places of worship were all closed. So a church, a mosque, a temple, it is still possible to have, you know, a religious type of service as well. And limiting to 30 is such a lot. It's a lot better than actually, you know, the weeks we've spent where actually it was a maximum of 10 people. And I think what we've seen is people start to be creative about funeral attendance and saying, actually, you know, I don't need to be there in person because the funeral is being streamed, you know, on the internet. So I can probably log on and watch it or watch a recording of it. And even if technology isn't your thing, if you know the day and the time of the funeral, I've been advising, you know, people, and we have been advising people to perhaps, you know, take that time to maybe light a candle, you know, in an area of quiet reflection, or play, you know, some suitable and apt music, or even just find a quiet place and just reflect on the life of the person. And that that empathy at the same time as the actual funeral service taking place, I think that's quite powerful.
It is indeed. And you talked there about streaming. Is that something that is available for all funerals?
I would like to say that there's a live streaming service at every crematorium, for example, in England, Wales and Scotland. But I know there are just under 30 of the 300 or so crematoria that are still without streaming services. And obviously it's a little bit unfortunate. We've had plenty of time. They've had plenty of time to actually realise the importance of this. Probably before COVID, streaming was becoming more and more popular because of many families now who live, you know, not just at the other side of the country, but at the other side of the world from each other. And they simply can't get back and get together for the funeral. So I can't say enough how important it is that the crematory use their streaming service, that they, you know, that the system is overhauled and is ready to and is robust.
What about the follow-up to a funeral, usually referred to as a wake? Is that still permissible?
In England, it is. But the premises has to be open. So it has to be, you know, a premises that can handle, you know, that. And obviously there's a, you know, restaurants and hotels and things are very restricted in this sense. And what's very key, it's not a wake in the normal sense, because if it has to be table service, so it's not a sort of a buffet or anything like that. And, you know, you have to respect as well safe social distancing and obviously, you know, the household issue of no more than six people. So it is technically it's possible, but actually practically it's probably very difficult to hold that wake. And that's challenging, because I've always found as a funeral director full-time funeral director for over 35 years, nearly 40 years experience in the industry, in the profession, the wake is the time, the post-funeral reception, that's the time when you can really swap stories and memories. And, you know, going from saying goodbye physically to the person, you know, at the funeral, you know, you can leave the wake with some really positive memories that you can keep forever. And so, you know, that post-funeral reception, that wake has got real importance. But we've got to recognise that, you know, at funerals and wakes, this is a time when we really, you know, we're in very close contact with people. We want to show our sympathy and support by hugging and, you know, arms around shoulders and things. And those are exactly the environment that the COVID virus wants to be able to spread. And it won't stop at funerals. So I think it's really important we recognise that we've all got a social responsibility to understand why we've got to socially distance, no matter, you know, how strongly we feel about wanting to hug someone or putting our arm around their shoulders.
David, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for your and your colleagues' work.
Thank you, Chris.
Chris English has been talking to David Collingwood, the Director of Funerals at Co-op Funeral Care. Well, for some years now, the organisation Butterfly Conservation have been running an annual butterfly count, which they describe as the Big Butterfly Count, and last year was no exception. Maya Davis, who's keen on wildlife, went to talk to Dr. Zoe Randall to find out more about it, and here's the interview.
Hello, Zoe, and welcome to At Home This Morning. It's very kind of you to agree to talk to us. Now, my only experience of this kind of citizen science is the Big Garden Bird Watch, and that's organised very, very tightly. You've got to watch for an hour over a very tight period of 3 days. Why is this organised in a very different way, any old 15 minutes in a three-week period?
Been organised this way so that it is a quick and simple way of contributing to conservation. You know, we've all got busy lives, but many of us can easily find 15 minutes in which to take part in the Big Butterfly Count, either by visiting the website or by downloading the free smartphone app. So it's basically accessible to all. It's an awareness-raising campaign, as well as generating vital data to help us keep on top of what's happening to our butterflies, which in turn reflects on how healthy our wider environment is.
Okay, and 15 minutes means you can just pop out in a sunny interval if it's a typical British summer day.
Absolutely. I mean, we're really fortunate that the weather seems to be on our side at the moment during this big butterfly count, which runs from the 17th of July until the 9th of August. And it's accessible to anybody. You don't have to go anywhere special to take part. You can just spend 15 minutes in your back garden or out on a countryside walk or in the hospital garden if you can get there and just spend 15 minutes counting the butterflies. Take some time out, pause, relax, because all of that relaxation and spending time with nature gives us a really good sense of our personal well-being and enables us to relax and unwind in an uncertain world.
Really, you're encouraging anybody and everybody to get involved, and you're making it as easy as possible.
Absolutely, because we need people to understand why butterflies and moths are so important and why nature is so important. And butterflies have been studied for over 300 years in the UK. They're beautiful, they're iconic, and most people have a natural affinity to them. They are beacons of hope. When I see my first brimstone butterfly in the spring, it's a magical experience for me. It really brightens me, lifts my mood, and it's like, hooray, we've got through the winter. The spring is here, the summer's coming, amazing, fabulous. So like I said, beacons of hope and symbols of transformation and rebirth.
Butterflies really do make everybody's day, and they are so important as pollinators.
They are, and also food for other creatures. So blue tip chicks eat an estimated 35 billion caterpillars a year. And quite often you can see a butterfly flying through the garden and then it's intercepted and snapped just like that out of the sky by a bird. So a really important part of the food chain as well. And not to mention just the fact that they are beautiful in their own right.
What about people who don't really know anything much about butterflies or moths? I'm not sure I could tell a large white from a small white at a distance.
That is one thing. Small whites and large whites and even green-veined whites from a distance can be tricky. But once they settle down onto a lovely buddleia flower spike, you can tell the difference because the large white's got a lot more black on the edge of its wings. There's an ID chart that you can download from the bigbutterflycount.org website to help you with your identifications.
I noticed that the Big Garden Birdwatch asks people to indicate the habitat in which the count occurred. Do you need to know that?
Yeah, there's a box on the website when you log your sightings which asks you what, you know, your location and the habitat type.
And what about butterflies or moths not listed on the sheet? Do you want to know about those?
Well, what we'd like people to do with those is send their sightings to their local county moth recorder or their local county butterfly recorder. And information about them and the contact details can be found on the Butterfly Conservation website.
Both the ID chart and the submission forms are available only online. Aren't you excluding people who might actually be really interested and very good from taking part?
Well, it's online because Butterfly Conservation is a charity, and obviously we are resource limited. We don't have the resources for people to enter all the data if it was sent in on paper. The thing is, with the lockdown, we've all got to know our neighbours a lot better and the people that live on our street and such like. So it could be that, you know, you get the whole street together and take part, and there'll be somebody on your street or neighbours that can do log the sightings for you.
Finally, I noticed that last year you counted over 1.5 million butterflies and the Painted Lady was well in the lead. What do you expect to happen this year?
Painted Lady had a phenomenal year last year. This is one of our regular migratory species, and every 10 years or so they have bumper years. Last year was one of those bumper years. I've not actually seen a Painted Lady yet myself this year, but what we're really hoping is that species like the brimstone, which has had a good spring emergence, high numbers, we're hoping that the subsequent broods of that species will have bumper numbers this year as well, which is why we need people to take part in the count. Our weather patterns are changing dramatically, and so butterflies can help us track that. And we want to see what these weather patterns are doing to butterfly populations and distributions. By taking part in the count, you can do that. One of the other species that we're really keen to know about this year is the small tortoise shell. bat species has suffered a 79% decline since the 1970s. So it is in trouble. It's not a specialist species. It lays its eggs on stinging nettles, which are virtually everywhere. You can't go anywhere without getting stung by a stinging nettle. And so what we'd like to see, that butterfly has had a really good spring. We're hoping that subsequent generations, a second brood will be booming and it will be a bumper one for people to spot in the big butterfly count. And if that's the case, then this butterfly bouncing back this year in the big butterfly count will be absolutely fantastic news.
Maya Davis was talking to Dr. Zoe Randall about the work of butterfly conservation, and in particular about the big butterfly count that they hold every summer. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to their website, which is www.butterfly-conservation.org. That's www.butterfly-conservation.org. And I'm sure they'll be holding another big butterfly count this coming summer. We'll try and remember to tell you about it on the programme, but obviously you can find out about it from the website. And we stay with Maya for our final item, which is on the subject of so-called hyperfoods. We all know that certain foods are good for us and others are less good, but there are a huge number of ingredients in normal foods which have useful properties, such as fighting against cancer. Recently, a couple of researchers have produced a cookery book, which lists many of these so-called hyperfoods and gives recipes on how you can use them. The researchers are Dr. Kirill Veselkov from Imperial College London and Yosef Youssef, who's a chef working for a group called Kitchen Theory. Maya Davis recently spoke to them to find out more. The project is being run in conjunction with Vodafone, who describe it as making use of artificial intelligence. So Maya began by asking Kirill what the connection is between food and artificial intelligence.
Well, as part of the project that we are currently working together in partnership with Vodafone Foundation, harnessing the processing power of smartphones, combining it with artificial intelligence technology and the omics data to look at the anti-cancer properties of bioactive components in foods. So if we currently think about national databases, they are actively monitored about 150 different components in foods. These include minerals, vitamins, and macronutrients such as protein, fats, and carbohydrates. But there are hundreds of thousands of other biologically active molecules. We call them dark matter because they're currently not being actively traced by national databases that have a profound impact on our health, but we understand very little about them. And that's where artificial intelligence, machine learning, and supercomputing comes into play.
Right. So, Joseph, how does that have implications for normal purchasing of food and people's diets?
Well, through identifying particular ingredients in the research, obviously that allows us to then highlight specific ingredients that maybe have curative properties for certain ailments. So in this case, a lot of focus was on cancer-beating molecules. So then if we have these ingredients, and some of the ingredients that were listed in the research are very accessible, so we're talking about things like carrots, celery, cabbage, oranges, grapes, coriander, tea, dill, and many, many others. But it's really about taking a change in perspective on food. And rather than just seeing food as something that's kind of like delicious and that we like eating, we all intuitively know that there's something about what we put in our bodies and how that affects our metabolic health. And what this research is doing is allowing us to just kind of understand more of what's going on inside the food and more of the properties that the food has in terms of prevention or in terms of overcoming certain diseases and illnesses. So essentially, the Hyperfoods cookbook that we've produced has a fruit and veg focus, cooking from scratch and eating a varied diet. It's not deviating too much from what we all intuitively know to be right, but what it's doing is putting some science behind it and going deeper than what we currently do.
So what is the difference between a hyperfood and a superfood?
The key difference that in hyperfoods we wanted to stress at the bioactive components that they have not been currently traced and discovered yet in terms of their cancer fighting or disease fighting in general potential. So that's not the minerals, vitamins, and micronutrients that are currently being traced, but these bioactive components that are actually specifically fruits and vegetables, as Joseph mentioned, contain hundreds of thousands of these molecules coming from diverse chemical classes like terpenoids, indoles, flavonoids. We know very little about them. And the emphasis here was to design next generation hyperfoods that would have cancer preventative or cancer beating properties, in addition to the standard of care, of course.
So, Joseph, what sort of foods were you thinking of that would fulfill the conditions Kirill mentioned?
This isn't about looking at exotic, rare and expensive ingredients. The aim of this research was actually to just go back and look at just everyday ingredients, like I mentioned, like cabbage, carrot, tea, dill, and ingredients that people are most likely consuming. But I guess there's not as much hype around these ingredients because we take them for granted.
So the focus was very much on cancer-beating molecules rather than general improvement in diet.
In this case, yes, but the team, and Kirill can talk about this more, are now focusing on antiviral foods too.
Yes, well, that's hardly surprising, is it, in view of the current situation?
The recipes we have tried to, again, keep very down-to-earth and affordable and accessible for people. That was extremely important. And the main focus of each of the 10 recipes that we have put together have been based on the list of hyperfoods ingredients that Kirill and his research team identified. But really, most importantly about this is the cookbook is there, number one, to give people an introduction to the idea of hyperfoods and this way of looking at food as having a more functional role in our day-to-day lives as part of our well-being and health. And the recipes themselves are there to give people an indication to just how down-to-earth and everyday and accessible these kinds of foods are and how easy they can be to put together. Again, we wanted this to be as accessible in a skill level as well as affordable for people and really just to give people a bit of a guide as to how straightforward it can be once you identify the right ingredients to actually put them together to achieve a healthier diet.
So would one of you like to explain to me how you can get hold of this cookbook?
Yes, you can go to www.kitchen-theory.com or just search Kitchen Theory online and it's available free to download as a PDF there. And of course, there's always more information on the Vodafone News Centre.
Where does Vodafone come into this?
Vodafone Foundation actually developed a DreamLab app that allows you to donate the processing power of your smartphone to help us to speed up the research. And actually, the cool component of this project was that the discovery that we've made was done on this mobile supercomputing platform called DreamLab app with the help of tens of thousands of people across the UK. So Joseph likes to put it, it's for the people, by the people. So the idea was that the discovery has been made by the people and through the Hyperfood Cookbook, feeding it back to the people.
So it's a citizen science project in a way.
It's a citizen science project.
Well, thank you both very much indeed. It's been lovely talking to you and good luck with the next stage of the project.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Maya Davis was talking to Dr. Kirill Veselkov of Imperial College London and Josef Youssef of Kitchen Theory about their new Hyperfoods cookbook. If you'd like to get hold of the cookbook, it's available as a free download by going to the Kitchen Theory website, which is www.kitchen-theory.com/about. That's www.kitchen-theory.com/about. Once you get to that website, you have to click on the heading Hyperfoods Cookbook, and it'll take you to a page where you can download the cookbook. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of At Home This Morning. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in the last hour. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you in 4 weeks. Just before I go, I'd like to ask a favour of you. If you have been listening to At Home This Morning, and especially if you're a regular listener, I'd be grateful if you could drop me an email to let me know that so that we know how many listeners we've got. And of course, you can take that opportunity to say what you like about the programme, what you dislike, and to suggest items you might like us to cover in future. There are two ways to send us an email. You can either go to the Radio Revo website, click on the page devoted to At Home This Morning and scroll down to the bottom where there's a form that you can fill in to send an email. Or you can send an email directly to me at info@greymattersproductions.org.uk. That's info, spelt I-N-F-O, at greymattersproductions, typed all as one word, .org.uk. Well, it now only remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Revo, to wish you all the very best until I see you again. Take care, stay well, goodbye.